Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, I guess everyone out there has heard of the Underground Railroad of the Civil War era, in which runaway Southern slaves were smuggled north to safety. And most people know that an African-American woman named Harriet Tubman played a central role in it. Well, it turns out that as harrowing as that was to do, she actually did a lot more than that over a period of years. She was at various times a Civil War scout, a nurse, a spy, and even led black troops into battle against the Confederate Army. We tend to think of American freedom fighters as people like George Washington and Paul Revere. But honestly, Harriet Tubman has to be counted among them as one of the great freedom fighters in our nation's history. She's the subject of an upcoming PBS special documentary called Harriet Tubman, Visions of Freedom. It was written, co-produced, and co-directed by my guest today, Nicole London. Welcome, Nicole.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, Court.
Glad you could be on. I'll tell you what, let's just plunge in, Nicole, and tell us about Harriet Tubman's early life.
Well, there's so much that has been learned in recent years. There's been a recent upswing in scholarship about Harriet Tubman. And what I could tell you about that I learned on in doing this film about her early life, I actually had never really realized that she was from the part of Maryland. She was from the Eastern Shore. I actually more associated her with like Baltimore and Philadelphia. Mm. And also that Frederick Douglass had been born and raised for a time in roughly the same area. So that was very fascinating to me to realize that two great Americans had been reared in the same lands, in the same waters, you know, risen themselves, you know, up to greatness. And secondarily, what was really fascinating learning about her early life was that as an enslaved child, the kinds of tasks that she had to perform, that she had to trap muskrats, for instance, and became ill doing that. The fact that she had to play nursemaid to other children in terms of minding the master's children, you know, even so far as, you know, infants, when she herself was, you know, maybe 6 years old. So the kind of hard labor that she kind of had to endure as a young person, you know, this is preteen from childhood through infancy through 6 to 7 years, 8 years old, that she was still as a child enduring hard labor, you know, various degrees of hard labor. That was really interesting and something I hadn't really considered about her before.
Yeah, it sounds like her childhood was not really a childhood. She was just a working slave almost from the time she could move do anything. You know, it's funny, though, as you mentioned, we think of Maryland as almost a northern state. She was from the Eastern Shore of Maryland. But it was actually a border state where slavery was legal and widespread. Some others were Delaware, West Virginia, Kentucky, and Missouri. So were conditions for slaves different in a place like Maryland than they were in the Deep South? More humane, maybe?
Yes, and that was the second biggest revelation in taking on this film, really finding out how much different one's enslavement could be in Maryland, perhaps, compared to a Georgia, an Alabama, a Mississippi. In Maryland, first of all, in Maryland, there was about 50%, the black population in Maryland was about 50% free and 50% enslaved. So being enslaved, you could see what freedom looked like. You could see how, if you were to attain your freedom, how you would be able to move throughout the world. And beyond that, people who were free in Maryland intermarried with those who were enslaved. That was something that I never even considered before. Both Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass had met their spouses in Maryland. Frederick Douglass didn't get married in Maryland, but that's where they formed their first relationships and decided to become a union in Maryland. So that's something that couldn't really happen anywhere else except in Maryland because of the way that slavery was kind of played out there.
It's actually kind of bizarre and almost cruel. I mean, you know, you'd be an African person and people you knew were free and you were not. I mean, it's just kind of bizarre. I guess there are circumstances of people you knew would be very different from your own, and yet here you were stuck in this particular status.
Oh, beyond that, you know, any children, especially if born to the mother, would also be enslaved. So the risk that carried, if you wanted to start a family, that added an extra burden to what your family union could be. And it really incentivized a lot of people to escape their enslavement because they did want to start families.
So a free man could be married to a woman who is a slave, and all of their children would be slaves and subject to being sold down the river or whatever. Gee,
yes,
terrible. So she did try to escape from her slave owner with her brothers when she was 27, I saw in the trailer of your movie. So what happened there in that particular episode?
As it had happened, her owner, Eliza Brodus, or rather her husband, had passed away. And often to settle an estate, property settled to settle debts, and you know, slaves being property, there was that possibility that they would be sold to settle the debts of the estate. And having seen some of her family members already had been sold off, that's something they didn't want to risk. So her and her brothers had set out and tried to escape, but they lost nerve and they dragged her back, even though she wanted to try to continue on to freedom. So they dragged her back, and within a few days, it's really unclear how many days, if it was a full week or not, but she set out again on her own. She decided she didn't want the extra baggage of her brothers to weigh her down, and she escaped and made her way to Philadelphia to freedom.
So she, the woman, was braver than her brothers, it sounded like, and wanted to keep going, and they dragged her back. You know, there's a funny thing, I don't know the name of it exactly, but there's a Return of Runaway Slaves Act that was passed in the northern states at some point, where even in states where slavery was illegal, people were encouraged to catch runaway slaves and return them, often for a bounty, to the South and where they came from. And it just seems like a bizarre thing.
Right. You know, there have been several fugitive slave acts throughout the years. The one that most people know about that, you know, gets written the most about in history books is the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. And that one is the one that really kind of dropped the hammer, really drew a line in the sand in terms of how the federal government was going to handle slavery and, you know, and runaways. And so it incentivized every American, deputized every American to be on the lookout for slaves and to return them to their enslavement. And it really pushed that boundary, pushed people who were kind of lukewarm on what slavery meant to them and what, you know, aiding and abetting a slave would cost them, because you could be fined, you could be jailed if you were found helping a slave escape. And so that really kind of was one of the deciding factors in pushing towards the Civil War. It was a heavy act, and it was a flashpoint for a lot of people.
Yeah, that is bizarre. I know at one point, even before the time we're talking about here, when she was trying to escape, Harriet Tubman began having actual visions of freedom. So what prompted those, and what was that like?
Well, when she was 13 years old, she had been in a general store. This is one of the scenes that we depict in our film. She entered the store. A man was a slave was trying to escape their master, who dashed through the store. The master yelled at her to, you know, try to grab onto the escaping man. She refused, and he, in trying to slow the man down, had picked up a weight and threw it at the man who was escaping out the door, but instead it hit her and fractured her skull. And so for months she was laid up in bed with, you know, terrible headaches. So obviously there was no surgery available for her. Her mother tended to her. There was no any other medical attention given to her. And from this skull injury, she kind of developed what she calls these visions that she described as religious. You know, she would see figures. She would see herself flying above water, over fields. She would see family members. And these were, she interpreted as being messages from God. And in those, she also envisioned herself as free. And so she kind of took her, I guess, her life's calling from the visions that she had throughout the rest of her life. She actually, you know, and a lot of times she would end up fainting or, you know, having seizures just from the skull fracture throughout the rest of her life. But she took these as blessings or as messages from God to kind of lead her to do the work that she did.
Interesting. So the second time that she ran away, a week or so after the first time that you mentioned, was that when she finally broke out of slavery? Or if not, how did she get out of slavery herself?
Yes, that second time is when she actually made it. And it was, you know, only a very short time after she was dragged back by her brothers. Yeah, that fire was obviously still burning very hot within her to find her freedom.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Nicole London, who's the writer and producer and director of a film on the life of Harriet Tubman called Harriet Tubman, Visions of Freedom. So where and how did she start to become an activist, not just escaping herself, but working to help others escape?
I would say it was almost as soon as she got her own freedom. Once she crossed the line into Pennsylvania, once she started to establish a life in Philadelphia, she felt that she couldn't turn her back on her family. She couldn't turn her back on the people that she loved and that had reared her. And she felt that as long as I was free, they should be free as well. And so she became involved very much in the abolitionist movement that was very strong in Philadelphia. There was a man, William Still, who himself was a fugitive slave, or an escaped slave, who became very very well-to-do, relatively wealthy industrialist, of the time in Philadelphia. And he had a central station, on the Underground Railroad, which leads into the other idea that the Underground Railroad was not just something that Harriet Tubman had formed on her own. It was a whole network of people that had existed long before she found her own freedom. And she tapped into that network. She found her people, in Philadelphia. And immediately, she started to formulate the idea that she wanted to go back and free members of her own family, free even her brothers who had tried to drag her back. She ended up freeing them as well. But that all happened in Philadelphia. So, she found work. She found work as a domestic and started earning some money, but it never left her that she wanted to free her family. So she was always very busy. She always found ways to keep herself busy and to kind of see how she could kind of fund the work of her life.
I had actually always thought that she had created the Underground Railroad, but as you say, she didn't. It pre-existed her, and she just used it in her exploits to help others. But in the end, if we know roughly how many people did she assist in escaping slavery?
Individually, she helped about 70 people escape in slavery. In addition to that, because she was so tapped into this network, she could leave detailed instructions on how to escape slavery for someone else. As a lot of people may or may not know, which we detail in this film, that she was illiterate. She couldn't read or write. But she had incredible literacy in terms of landscape, in terms of how to navigate unfamiliar territory, or even better yet, familiar territory, how to force oneself to blend into the background. And so all of these types of information she was able to pass on to others, so that by the end of, her career in terms of liberation, she had freed almost 700 people.
Oh, my gosh. Did she ever lose any or get caught herself?
No, and it's a famous quote, but I could not quote myself. But the gist of it was that as a conductor on the Underground Railroad, she never lost a passenger. And that's something that real railroad conductors could never claim.
Yeah, that's really something in itself. I mean, it's like being a super canny scout to not, with people pursuing you, with dogs and everything else, to go...
Right.
That many times, that many trips, it's like, missions in World War II over Germany or something. There's only a certain number you can expect to make, but she did all those with 100% success. So where was she taking these people?
Just to piggyback on what you said, I like to say that she was a one-woman SEAL Team 6. She did exactly that. She could infiltrate enemy territory and, get her charges out safely. It was really remarkable what she was able to do. And a big part of her success was that it had to be incredibly secret and that no one could turn back, because nothing would be more dangerous than somebody who knew what her plans were and were caught or, forced or tortured or forced to tell what had happened and who had gotten them to freedom or who was trying to get them to freedom. And so she always had a pistol that she carried with her, which she used to great effect. She never had to use it, but she was absolutely willing to shoot someone to keep them on the path to freedom. Because once you started on that road, there was no turning back.
Tough lady. Okay. So, where did she take them to?
So Harriet Tubman would often, she had several routes to freedom that she liked to travel. But the main stops were Philadelphia, where they would stop and get new supplies. One of the instances we detail in the film is that Thomas Garrett, one of the famous abolitionists, had kitted her out and her group with new shoes because, of course, they had traveled the whole way by foot and worn the soles of their shoes completely out. So he bought them gave them $2 for these shoes, and they kept traveling on. Oftentimes, the last and final destination would be Canada, because the Fugitive Slave Act couldn't be enforced there. It wasn't enough to get to New York. It wasn't enough to get to Massachusetts. Even Philadelphia, it was not enough to stay there, because, as I mentioned, the 1850 Fugitive Slave Act deputized everyone in America to, you know, to buy into helping to recapture escaped slaves. So, you know, America wasn't safe for anyone, especially those who had escaped. But it could be even dangerous for those who were free, because they could be caught up in that web of, I guess, almost like bounty hunting, you could say.
Crazy. So all the way to Canada, you're basically a fugitive still, and having to hide all the way up to Canada, which is a long way to travel from Maryland or further south, wherever it might be. Wow.
Yes, and that's why there's like there had been a vibrant community of escaped African Americans, and particularly St. Catherine in Canada.
So the Underground Railroad, I guess, had to extend all the way up there, and that involved trusting and being able to connect with a long linkage of people who were, in effect, the stations on the Underground Railroad, right?
Exactly. Frederick Douglass himself was one of those stations. And of course, there were a lot of Quakers involved. They were famously anti-slavery, anti-enslavement. Of course, there was a huge abolitionist population in Massachusetts. But what we also wanted people to know and understand about the Underground Railroad is that the majority of people on the that were conducting the Underground Railroad were also Black Americans, African Americans who had been formerly enslaved, who might be still enslaved, but new information. So there was a whole network of people that you could go, even if it wasn't to stay, they could tell you that, you know, you can't stay here, but you can go to the next house. You know, you should go at night, you know, you should go at this time of day and knock three times, or, you know, things like that. So it was huge network, clandestine, and it was actually pretty well documented, but of course it had to remain secret. So a lot of this, of course, didn't come out until after slavery was abolished.
Sure. So let's switch gears a little bit time-wise. When the Civil War started, she began to broaden her activities, and Tubman worked for the Union Army, first as a cook and a nurse, and then as an armed scout and spy. So tell us kind of briefly about that period.
At the start of the Civil War, she wanted to do more. She knew that she had helped free so many people, but she felt that she could do something more. So she ended up going south into South Carolina, into the southern states, you know, as a Union nurse, as you had mentioned. But as a nurse especially, she became privy to information, because a lot of soldiers had been seen combat, knew her, especially the formerly enslaved people who were escaping the South. They knew exactly what had been on their plantations. They knew if Southern troops were stationed where and how far from certain plantations. They knew how much ammunition they had. They knew how many horses they had, how many men. All of these things that, you know, because nobody considered them human, they didn't consider them as, I guess, liabilities in that way. And so, but Harriet Tubman, being as smart as she was and resourceful, this was gathering intelligence. And so she was able to take that intelligence to the Union superiors and, you know, help them kind of plan excursions throughout the South that would help, you know, not just liberate slaves, but help to win the war.
You know, one exploit that really stood out to me, and I mentioned it in the outset, was that she was the first woman to lead an armed expedition in the war, and not only a woman, but a Black woman at that. So she led the raid at, Combahee Ferry, which liberated more than 700 enslaved people. I think John Brown called her General Tubman. So, you know, tell us just briefly about that. And also, was there ever a price put on her head by the Confederates because she began to be such a threat in so many different ways?
To be honest, I don't recall if there was a price by the Confederates specifically. I don't recall in terms of money, but they were certainly writing about her. It was written about in a number of newspapers that this woman had led this raid, as well as the Northern newspapers. You know, it was very interesting to see the difference in how in how they wrote about her. But yes, that the Combahee River raid is a key turning point, at least in her career. And yes, she's the first woman, the first black woman to lead a military raid. And it was exactly because of the intelligence that she had gathered from the people that she'd talked to who were escaping the South. She was, you know, they were able to put together a team of scouts. Obviously, not being from South Carolina herself, she befriended these men who were from South Carolina, and they were able to plot out ways to figure out how to really hurt the Southern forces in that region. They knew exactly where the landmines were in the water because they'd been observing all of this, you know, as they were enslaved. And so gathering all of that intelligence, she was able to create a plan to kind of really go in there and penetrate into enemy territory. And as they did so, and it's one of the you know, livelier scenes of the film is when we kind of describe the newspaper reactions of how she did that and how remarkable it was that she was standing, you know, this figure on the helm of a ship as it sails up the Combahee River, and that the people seeing her from the shores, seeing that their liberator has come, and she was singing as they sailed up the Combahee River. It's kind of an amazing image to hold in your mind, you know, the fact that she was able to do this at that time, and it's never been done since.
Yeah, I'm surprised that particular point isn't more famous. I mean, as you just describe it, it's a very visual thing and so unusual. I mean, totally unique up to that time, and just a really iconic kind of thing. And I can imagine it was a major burr under the saddle of the Confederacy at that moment.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Because they and of course they talked about how much they lost that day, how much nobody was killed, I believe, but it was but how much livestock they lost, how much how many of the goods, the packaged goods, you know, the things that were housed on these plantations, the ammunitions that they lost, that were seized by the Union forces. You know, there was very much a monetary tally associated with this, which, you know, you could say that's where they hurt them the most.
Yeah, not to mention 700 slaves,
and,
which hurts,
well,
too.
You know, property to them.
Yep. So what were her activities in her life like after the war ended? I mean, I think she did not immediately become, you know, a wealthy, celebrated icon. What happened with her afterwards?
Oh, she Harriet Tubman was someone that could never be idle. So even after the war, she started to lobby for veterans' rights, especially for black veterans, having newly been deputized into the Union Army at the start of the Civil War, during the Civil War, rather. A lot of them found themselves ineligible for pensions. So she was able to kind of wrangle some pensions for some of them, including herself. She was able to, she had a home for veterans as well. She had a couple of homes for women, for indigent children. She was tirelessly working for others. It never for the benefit of herself. She just had a calling to help others, and she just kept going at it throughout the rest of her life.
Yeah, later in life, I think she even became a suffragette, working to gain the vote for all women. So just tell us, we're kind of toward the end of the show here, but just tell us briefly about that period.
Yeah, so she became friends with Elizabeth Cady Stanton, several other notable suffragists, I guess the word is now. She attended the big suffragette, I guess, convention, which of course the name is now escaping me, but she was there and she gave a speech. And of course, she was a figure of great inspiration for suffragists. Here was someone who had a quarter of the privileges of many of the women that were agitating for the right to vote. And yet here was this woman who was kind of taking on huger battles on her own, you know, completely self-motivated with incredible agency. And here was, you know, and also someone who couldn't vote. And it's like, and she became kind of a lightning rod for a lot of them who was like, you know, even if you couldn't, you know, deny us the right to vote, here's someone who's a great American, who was acknowledged as a great American, who also doesn't have a right to vote. Who more better suited to kind of plead that case than Harriet Tubman?
So, you know, by the end of her life, and I think she died in 1913, was her heroism and her activities and her life finally recognized? Did she finally become famous?
She actually was pretty well known by the time she passed away. She was listed in the New York Times as one of the 100 greatest Americans that year, I think. But she had also had gotten a shawl, I think, from Queen Victor. I forget which queen. It was a queen, though. A queen of
one
England.
Of those queens. You're right.
I don't want to get it wrong. Say the wrong queen. But she was gifted a shawl by one of the queens. So she was definitely someone of note, living in upstate New York at the time, in Auburn, New York. So people knew about Harriet Tubman. She'd been written about, you know, so she was often appearing in the newspapers. I mean, that's public record. So, you know, celebrity being different at that time, she was definitely not as famous, I guess you'd say, as Frederick Douglass. But then she didn't have benefit of being literate to kind of write her own story the same way he did. She didn't have her image taken as often as he did. You know, all of these things he understood about representation and, I guess, you know, publicity and marketing in a lot of ways. That's something she just didn't really, you know, gel with. So, you know, she was very much modest and very much kind of just did the work, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she was just about doing the work and, you know, keeping that moving. But Frederick Douglass also had more of a style about him. And so, you know, he had written in her biography, he'd written a letter of support for this biography. He had outlined, he's like, so much of what I do is in the public, and so much of what you do is undercover, under shade of night, behind the scenes. And, you know, you're no less great for having done it, because the people that you helped are more directly and grateful to you. That's no less valuable or worthy.
So, Nicole, this is kind of an unfair question because we are at the end of the show, but, and it's hard to answer briefly, I know, but overall, what would you say is the legacy of the life of this great woman we're talking about, Harriet Tubman?
Well, to me, so much of her legacy is, you know, the inspiration that we can all take from her story. That, you know, here's someone that literally started with nothing, doesn't even really know the date of her own birth, who couldn't read or write, but made such an indelible mark on American history. It's what you could take from that is that there is no limitations to what you can achieve, no limitations because of your birth, because of your sex, because of the color of your skin, that you can do anything and you can really impact the course of history for a nation. It's an incredibly inspiring story, and I don't think I defy one to find one more inspired than Harriet Tubman.
Yep, okay. Well, good answer. It's a story of inspiration and will and courage. So, again, the documentary that Nicole is instrumental in producing, Harriet Tubman, Visions of Freedom, will air on PBS on Tuesday, October 4th. You can look it up at pbs.org under shows, or just search Tubman, or you can watch TV that night on October 4th. And before that date, you can watch a variety of short clips on pbs.org. Well, Nicole, I want to thank you so much for being on with us. Interesting show. And thanks to all of you out there for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.